Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Maxwell here to welcome you to Michael's Saturday Surprise for Saturday, February the 10th, 2018. Well, I have an interesting theme tonight. It deals with going on a holiday, dealing with a mystery, and the feats of heroism. What makes us a hero? Plus, when you're lonely, is there a way you can get some relief from your loneliness? Well, sometimes we use drugs, but sometimes companionship can really help, especially beyond this world. Let's start with our first program. Here is Box 13 and Last Will and Nursery Rhyme, aired on February the 6th, 1949.
Box 13, with the star of Paramount Pictures, Alan Ladd, as Dan Holliday.
Dear Dan, I'm inviting you up to Fair Oaks to spend the last weekend with me. Forget your Box 13 gag for a while and grab yourself a little vacation. There's not much I can offer in the way of excitement or adventure. But if you'll really go any place or do anything, you might like to see the crumbling grandeur of the last weekend.
Crumbling grandeur of the last of the Kenworths. You know how to get there, and I'll be waiting. How about it? Tick. Vacation, the man said. You know, someday I'm really going to take a vacation. But this wasn't it.
Back to Box 13 and Dan Holliday's newest adventure, Last Will and Nursery Rhyme.
I think you should go, Mr. Holliday. You need a rest.
Oh, Susie, every time I go for a rest, something happens to me.
But what can happen at a nice, quiet place like Fair Oaks? Gee, from what your friend Ted says about it, it's just the spot to take it easy.
You're sure of that, huh?
Uh-huh. Why, you'll come back all full of vim and vinegar.
Okay, Susie, you talk me into it. Forward my mail to Fair Oaks, care of Ted Kenworth. It was pleasant, a 200-mile drive through the countryside. I was forgetting all about Box 13. It chased after me all the way up to Fair Oaks. I got there in the evening, and Ted was waiting for me. Maybe I should explain Ted and Fair Oaks. You see, Ted was my closest friend at college, and, well, he had inherited Fair Oaks. One of those big, overdone houses people were fond of building in the 1890s. It looked like an insane wedding cake. Gingerbread balconies, all running around and contributing nothing to the architectural value of the place. Anyway, I parked on the drive, walked up the stairs with Ted and into the house.
Oh, I'm glad you came, Dan. I've been wanting to have you up here for a long time, but guess I never got around to it.
Hey, what do you do for space here? Suppose you have a house full of guests and you've only got 20 rooms.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. I won't have it long.
What do you mean?
Come on in here. It's the only room with chairs.
Hey, why the crepe hanging?
Oh, I'm selling, Dan.
Selling? Oh, but you're kidding.
No, I wish I was kidding, but can't keep this place up.
You're broke?
Flattered in last week's pancakes.
Oh, but I thought you inherited a
money
lot of money
from Uncle Thaddeus? No. Not a thin, round dime.
Oh, now, wait a minute. He had $1,000 for every breath he took.
Did he?
I'm asking.
I'm telling. No, Dan. All he left me was this house.
Are you sure?
There we go again. Look, fella, I've been asked that question a million times. All he left was the house.
It doesn't seem right. Wasn't he a millionaire?
Uh-huh.
Then where's his money?
Gone. Finished. Kaput.
But look, where could a guy like your Uncle Thaddeus spend all of his money?
That's the gold-plated question. He never spent a nickel if he could help it.
Okay, then the money's still with us.
Dan, you kill me. You're so tied up with fiction that you look for a deep, dark plot in everything.
Yeah, but this makes no sense.
It does when you check and find out that Uncle Thaddeus lived the last 5 years on credit.
Credit? You mean with all of his dough?
Ah, that's right.
Well, there must be a record of the money.
I had help looking for it.
Help? Who?
Uncle Sam. Oh. Income tax, inheritance tax. If they couldn't find the dough, how could I? No, Dan, Uncle Thaddeus fooled everybody. He didn't have a nickel.
Well, it sounded offbeat to me. Uncle Thaddeus lived close to his vest. And he had had money at one time, lots of it. He never went anyplace, did anything. But a cool $3 million or so just curls up and evaporates. Or did it? Anyway, I thought about it later that night.
Oh, why don't you stop, Dan? You're supposed to take a vacation and you're beating your brains out.
Now listen, put it together and what have you got? Uncle Thaddeus, practically a hermit. He's known to have money, but when he dies, all he leaves is this, well, this oversized lean-to.
Dan, I've looked through the whole house. I know it like the back of my hand. I lived here when I was a kid after Mother and Dad died.
What about the will?
Uncle's?
Yeah.
Well, nothing about money in it.
Oh, excuse me, Ted.
Oh, it's okay. Come on in, Helen.
Oh, I didn't knock or ring the bell. I didn't know you had company.
Oh, it's all right. Helen, this is Dan Holliday. Dan, this is Helen Stark.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Helen's clearing out odds and ends for me, Dan.
Odds and ends?
Well, I was Thaddeus Kenworth's secretary. That is, once in a while I was. When he got behind in cataloging books, I came in and did it for him.
Oh.
Sit down, Helen. Join the wake.
Well, I haven't much time. I want to sort out some papers. You can look them over tomorrow, Ted.
I don't want to. Throw them out.
What papers?
Mr. Kenworth kept everything.
Yeah, he collected bills, receipts, pieces of twine, bits of paper.
Oh, he wasn't that bad.
Okay, just like to keep things.
Including money.
Yeah.
What do you mean, Mr. Holliday?
Where's his money?
Well, he didn't leave any.
That's what the man said.
But he didn't, did he, Ted?
No.
Then where is it?
Helen, let me explain. You see, Mr. Holliday has a complex. To him, the simple act of taking a drink of water is filled with mystery and dark meaning.
Want to borrow my cloak and dagger?
Well, you two argue about it. I'll be all finished tomorrow, Ted, and you can look over everything. See you later, Mr. Holliday.
Oh, good.
Nice girl.
Uh-huh.
What's the matter? Don't you like her?
I just met her. What do you want me to do, start sending orchids?
Hey, come on, let's take a walk, huh?
I'd rather go over the house.
Oh, you're kidding. Why?
Oh, just to take a look.
Oh, expect to find a million tucked away in an old pillowcase?
You never can tell, boy. Come on, just to satisfy my curiosity. Okay, I satisfied my curiosity. Ted knew the old place backward and forward. Almost all of the furniture had been cleared out. And if there was a hiding place for anything, we'd have found it. But it still bothered me, and it bothered me after I finally went to bed. Then, in the middle of the night, somebody was taking a walk in the house. I got out of bed, opened my door, and went to Ted's room. Ted. Ted, wake up.
Huh? Huh? What's the matter? Oh, Dan.
Be quiet.
Hmm? What's the matter with you? You walking in your sleep?
I heard someone upstairs.
Oh, large mice. Go back to bed.
I tell you, I heard someone walking around. What's directly above my room?
Your room?
Yeah.
Why, this that old room I played in when I was a kid.
What's in there?
Oh, cut it out, will you, Dan?
What's in that room?
Nothing. You saw it. A trunk with some old toys in it, that's all.
I heard someone walking around up there.
Ah, you were dreaming. You've got your head so crammed
full. That's a car.
Huh? Yeah, so what?
But you and I are the only ones in the house.
That's what I said.
But someone just drove away from here.
That car was on the road, not on the grounds here.
Drove away from here.
All right, it drove away from here. Now go back to sleep. The next dream you have, tell Freud, not me.
I knew I'd heard someone upstairs. Somebody was going through that old room which Ted had used as a playroom when he was a kid. But why? Ted and I had gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, and there was nothing there. But the next morning, I wanted a better look, so Ted and I went back.
I don't know why I'm doing this except to humor you, Dan. There's nothing in this room.
Hey, how old is that horn?
I don't know. Maybe 20 years. Oh, get this. Ha ha. Uncle Thaddeus never threw away a thing.
Not even his money.
Oh, still harping on that, huh?
Yeah. Hey, what else is in that trunk?
Oh, baseball glove, dust, ball, bat. Gosh, this rabbit's almost as old as I am. Then, let's see, tops, strings, that's all.
And there's nothing else in the room.
Nope.
Yet someone was up here last night looking for something.
Oh, Dan, stop it.
What's the matter?
Nothing. Nothing, I guess.
Come on, come on, come on. What were you going to say?
Wait a minute.
Lose something?
I don't know.
Why don't you know?
Seems to me there's something missing from this bunch of junk.
What?
I can't remember. But there's one thing.
Toy? Horn? Train?
No. Those things are all here.
Then what's missing? Come on, Ted, think.
Oh, but it's more than 20 years ago. 25 is more like it.
Yet you know something's missing.
I don't know. It's just that something hit me, you know, like a name you try to remember, or a place, or a date.
All right. What?
I don't know, Dan. I can't remember.
Good morning. Good morning.
Oh, hiya, Mr. Wilson. Come on in.
Second childhood, Theodore. Playing with toys again?
No, just rummaging around. Dan, this is Martin Wilson, Uncle's attorney. Mr. Wilson, Dan Holliday.
How do you know? Well, Theodore, the papers are all ready for the sale. You can sign them anytime.
Oh, good. Be glad to get it off my mind. But I kind of hate to see the old place go.
Yes, yes, indeed. Staying long, Mr. Holliday?
No, just the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Were you looking for something, Theodore?
Huh? Oh, no, not in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're ready, we'll sign the papers.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Wilson, but could I take a look at the will?
Eh? Will? What will?
Thaddeus Kenworth.
What for?
Dan's a writer, Mr. Wilson. He's writing now.
But could I look at it?
That will be up to Theodore.
How about it, Ted?
And when you've looked at it?
I don't know. Is this the only will?
Of course. That's the only one I've been able to locate.
Well, Dan, what'd you find?
Just the house and all that's in it.
What?
And I said this clause states you'd receive the house and all that's in it.
Is there something curious in that, Mr. Holliday?
Maybe. Here's a clause that strikes me as being peculiar.
Which one's that?
Oh, listen. The happiest days of all of our lives are those spent in innocence. If you would become happy, Theodore, then remember your childhood and those things that were dear to you.
Yeah, maybe the old boy was right.
Do you read any odd meaning into that, Mr. Holliday?
Do you?
Old Thad was a peculiar man, a very peculiar person. He had streaks and quirks.
Yeah, and one of them was getting rid of a fortune in time to keep anyone else from enjoying it.
Maybe he thought people should work for their money.
What are you getting sore about, Mr. Wilson?
I'm not. Well, if you're quite finished with this will, Mr. Holliday...
Oh, yes, I am, thanks.
All right. We'd better get the business of signing the papers over with, Theodore. Can't make a buyer wait forever, you know.
All right.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, hi, Helen.
What is this? Why all the grim looks?
Nothing.
I'll be finished today, Ted. Then you can look over everything.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, Ted, want to go for a walk?
Oh, sure. Excuse me.
Of course. I'll finish my work in here, Helen. Won't disturb you, will I?
No, not at all. I'll work in the library.
What's the matter, Dan?
I'm just thinking.
About what?
I'm sure I heard someone in that room last night, Tim. The room you used as a playroom when you were a kid.
Now what?
That sentence in the will about your childhood. Remember it if you want to be happy.
Oh, look. Uncle Thad was a little, well, eccentric.
Maybe, but it ties in. The playroom, your childhood, someone looking for something, and you're feeling something was missing from that old trunk. Look out!
Huh? Ted.
You all right?
Yeah. But if you hadn't given me that push, I don't know.
That coping stone would have nailed you. It fell off of the roof.
Yeah. Hey, I guess it's about time to get rid of the place. It's falling apart.
That stone didn't fall, Ted. It was pushed off.
Now, back to Last Will and Nursery Rhyme, another Box 13 adventure with Alan Ladd as Dan Holliday.
Sure, that stone was pushed. Ted and I went to the roof, saw the marks made when the stone had been shoved forward. And it was meant to put the lights out for him. Why?
That's what I want to know. Why?
Because of something in this house someone wants to get and keep you from getting.
You know, you're almost making me believe this.
You've got to. And you've got to think what's missing from that old trunk.
Oh, I've tried, Dan. I can't.
There was nothing in it but toys?
That's all.
Yet you say they're all there.
Well, I think so.
Now, wait a minute. Let's go at this logically. There were trains, bats, baseball mitt, mechanical toys, things like that.
What are you getting at?
Well, this. You wouldn't have missed another of those things, so the thing that's missing must be different from those. Different enough to make you realize it's gone.
Yeah. You're beginning to make sense.
Now you try making some.
Oh, Dan, I can't.
Great. Look, would either Helen or Wilson know?
Know what? Oh, the thing that's missing?
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe.
Both Wilson and Helen were in the house when that stone almost put apart in your hair.
Yeah.
Either one could have shoved it off. It wasn't too big or too heavy.
Yeah, but why kill me?
Because the key to this whole business is in your head. As soon as you remember what's missing from the trunk, you'll have it.
And both Helen and Wilson have keys to this place.
And therefore, either one could have come into the house the night I heard the prowling in the playroom.
All right. Where do we start now?
We try to find what was taken. We didn't. Whoever had it had taken it away. And 2 hours of pounding at Ted didn't help. He just couldn't remember what it was. Okay. I had an idea and told Ted.
Hey, do you mean that?
Yes. You follow Wilson when he leaves, and I'll follow Helen.
Oh, I don't know.
Now, look, it's our only chance. Come right out and accuse either one, and that'll be the end. We've got to do it this way, Ted.
Well, all right.
Wait.
There you are, Theodore.
Oh, hello.
Holliday, how are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Good, good. Well, Theodore, it's all settled. You're getting a good price for this place, but you'll have to leave day after tomorrow.
What?
The terms of the sale. Buyer wants immediate occupancy.
Well, put it off.
What for?
Just put it off.
Look here, I sold this place for you, Theodore. Got a fine price.
Yeah, but I didn't know I'd have to leave right away.
You should have read the terms of the sale. Well, I've got to be going now. Other things to take care of.
How do you like that? I've got to get out.
Okay, that gives us less time. Now, you follow him. See what he does, where he goes, anything. I'll do the same with Helen. Helen didn't leave until that afternoon. I let her get a start and then drove after her. She didn't stop in the village. Kept going into town about 20 miles farther. I kept a safe distance behind. Then, in the town, stopped a car, got out. And so did I. Well, so far, this was a blind chase. Then she went into a store, and on the window was children's toys and books. Toys and books. Children's. I edged up to the window and looked in. Helen was talking with a clerk, and she had something in her hand. And from where I stood, it looked like one of those linen-covered kids' books. Then I saw the clerk go to a shelf of books and look them over. Helen followed her. The clerk shook her head. Helen turned to leave, and I ducked to keep out of sight. Helen went to every toy shop in town, but every place she got the same answer, shake of the head. Okay. So it was Helen who had taken the missing item from the trunk, and it was a kid's book. But why? And what was in that book? It was dark when she finally headed back to the village of Fair Oaks. She didn't know it, but she was going to get company that night.
Oh, hello there, Mr. Holliday.
Dan sounds better.
Well, so does Ellen.
I was just in the village, thought I'd drop in and say hello.
I'm glad you did, Dan. Sit down, won't you?
Oh, thank you. I'll finish at the house?
Yeah. Oh, things were in a mess. Thaddeus Kenworth kept everything under the sun.
Yes, including a secret.
Secret? What secret?
Oh, just any secret. I wonder what he did with his money.
Oh, I don't think he had any. I believe he was an old fraud. Why, he lived the last 5 years of his life on credit.
Uh-huh. And there must have been a good reason for everyone extending credit to him.
Well, he was an institution around here. Everybody humored him.
Well, maybe.
Why, maybe? Did you know him?
No, but tradesmen wouldn't extend credit for 5 years without expecting to get their money.
I don't know anything about that.
I'm sure you do.
Hmm? What?
How was your trip into town today, Helen? Pleasant? Profitable?
You're an odd person, Mr. Holliday.
The name's Dan, remember?
All right, you're still an odd person.
You didn't find what you were looking for, did you?
Was I looking for something?
All right, Helen, let's quit shadowboxing. You went into every toy shop in town that...
Was that a crime?
Oh, no. No, not at all. But shoving a stone off of a roof might be called one.
What does that remark mean?
Helen, I want what you took from the playroom at the house.
Well, I didn't take anything.
Oh, yes, you did. And among Uncle Thaddeus's papers, you must have seen a letter telling Ted to look in that trunk for a clue, some sort of a book.
Well, you're crazy.
But it's fun. Now, hand it over, Helen.
I told you I didn't take anything.
Listen, that stone just missed killing Ted.
Well, it...
And anyone who wants to kill someone has a strong motive. What's yours?
It was just an accident. I leaned on the stone.
Oh, sure. But how will it look if we put two and two together? The stone and the stolen book. I want it, Helen. Something funny?
All right, you can have it. But it won't do you any more good than it did me. Now, get out of here.
Oh, the lady's armed.
I'll kill you.
Go right ahead.
Stop there.
Must be a lot of money to make you attempt a murder and threaten another. I want that book, Helen. Now.
You stay away from me. Go. Go on.
Take it easy now. There. I'll take the gun with me. And the book. It was an old book of nursery rhymes, the kind kids look at hour after hour. I took it back to Ted and told him what had happened.
Helen? But why?
Why? For what I've been harping on since I've been here, your uncle's money. And this book is the clue.
Yeah, I remember it now. That's what was missing from the trunk.
Sure. Look, Ted, Helen went through your uncle's papers and found something.
I would have sworn it was Lawyer Wilson.
Yeah, that's something Helen was counting on, but I ruled him out.
Why?
Well, when I first saw the will, I noticed it had been drawn up by another firm of attorneys. If you remember, Wilson even admitted he had to hunt for it. Then Helen must have found the letter telling you to look for this book.
Yeah, but there's nothing but nursery rhymes. We've been through it a dozen times, and there's not a mark or a piece of paper in it.
Yes, I know, but we've got it.
Yeah, we've got it. And I've got to get out of here.
You've got to figure this out before you leave. Once you're out of here, you'll have as much chance of finding that
money. Yeah, I know. But...
Come on. Now, let's look through it again. See anything?
No.
Well, keep looking at it. Wait a minute.
What's the matter?
Go back.
What did you see?
I didn't see anything. It was something I didn't see.
Oh, Dan, you're crazy.
Look, Ted, look. Each rhyme is numbered. 1, 2, 3, 4, then 6. Number 5 is missing.
Hey, you're right. Helen took it.
No, she didn't.
What?
Of course she didn't. That's why she was trying to buy another one like it. But she couldn't. It's too old. All right. Number 5 is missing. What was it?
Oh, hey, I can't remember that.
Yes, you can. Now, look. Number 1, Little Miss Muffet.
Yeah.
Number 2, Simple Simon. 3, Sing a Song of Sixpence. 4, 3 Blind Mice.
Wait a minute. Wait. Mice. Mice?
No. That one's here.
No. Not Hickory Dickory Dock. The mouse ran up the clock. It's not there, and I know it was.
Your uncle took it out rather than mark it. He took it out to make it tough for you.
Yeah, but why that one?
Ted. In the hall, that grandfather's clock.
Yeah. I used to watch it for hours when I was a kid.
Well, come on.
Hey, Dan, you're terrific.
Okay, here's the clock, but it's stopped. I tried to wind it the other day, but it wouldn't go.
Now listen, the rest of the rhyme. The clock struck one.
One. 1 o'clock.
This clock stopped at six. Now, what'll happen when we turn the hands until they get to one?
Well, don't just stand there, boy. Do it.
Okay. Seven. Eight. Nine. 10. 11. 12.
Easy.
One. Look, the face came open.
Hey, there's a letter.
Well, get it out and read it.
Yeah, read it. My dear nephew, since you've figured this out, I must assume you've learned that money is to be earned, not come by easily. All right, go to the sundial in the garden. Turn the indicator until it points to 12. You'll then be able to lift the face of the dial. In the column, you'll find negotiable bonds and securities. You'll... Dan, I...
I know. You love me.
Did you have a nice time, Mr. Holliday?
Great, Susie, great. Do I look rested?
Well, not exactly.
That's what I thought.
Oh, maybe you won't want to go to the party tonight, then.
What party?
Well, we're all starting from the City Hall.
Starting from the City Hall? Why?
Oh, it's a treasure hunt. It'll be loads of fun.
Oh, Susie, how do you manage it? Good night.
Next week, same time, through the courtesy of Paramount Pictures, Alan Ladd stars as Dan Holliday in Box 13. Box 13 is directed by Richard Sandville, with an original story by Russell Hughes. Original music is composed and conducted by Rudy Schrager. The part of Susie is played by Sylvia Picker. Production is supervised by Vern Karstensen. This is a Mayfair production from Hollywood. Watch for Alan Ladd in his latest Paramount picture.
Well, folks, that was Box 13 and Last Will and Nursery Rhyme, aired February the 6th, 1949. Now we're going to hear our second program. Here is X-1 and C-Shoot, aired on February the 8th, 1956.
In just a moment, X-1. But first, there's a certain water commissioner whose interest in the ladies sometimes overshadows his interest in civic affairs. His name is a familiar one, Throckmorton P. Gildersleeve, and he'll pursue his adventures tomorrow night when NBC Radio presents another comic episode of The Great Gildersleeve. So when you hear the familiar voice and hearty laugh of the water commissioner from Summerfield tomorrow, why, stay tuned and enjoy another romantic scramble with the one and only The Great Gildersleeve on this NBC station. And I'll stay tuned for X-1 on NBC.
Countdown for blast-off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight's story, The Sea Chute by Isaac Asimov.
We were on our way home to Earth when it happened. Six of us coming home as passengers aboard the merchant spaceship Starfire at the start of the Second Interstellar War, the one between Earth and the planet Chloral. And then it happened.
Now hear this. Condition red. Condition red. We are under attack from a Chloran battlecruiser. All hands forward to battle stations. Passengers will remain confined to the after cabin. Condition red. We are being attacked.
The interception by the Chloran cruiser, the murderous running duel of energy blasts and force field defenses. We huddled in the passenger's after cabin, terrified, not knowing how the battle was going. We could hear the desperate bursts of steam through the steering tubes as the Starfire maneuvered to dodge the enemy attacks. And then...
Now what?
Beginning of the end, you might call it.
Well, what does it mean, Stuart? You were a space pilot.
It means our generators have been drained of energy. We can't fight back.
But, Monsieur,
all right, don't worry. They won't destroy us. They need our ship too badly. They'll simply board us and take over.
But what about the crew?
The crew, Colonel? If they have any sense, they'll surrender. If they choose to fight, they'll... Now, they're coming aboard. Now, be very still.
Oh, Mother, in heaven, help
us. Be still?
If only those fools on deck will surrender without a struggle.
They are fighting.
Yes, it's the end.
We've got to help them.
All right, don't open that door.
We just can't let them die.
You can't help them.
I'm going.
Stop him.
All right.
Anastasia.
Shut the door quickly.
Anastasia, my brother.
That poor fool.
I'll get them. My brother, I swear to God, get them.
Yeah, you better cover his body.
The brutes. The monstrous green-skinned brutes.
They're no more brutes than we are, Colonel. This is a war.
Are you defending them?
I'm merely pointing out the facts.
I ought to strangle you.
Why not save it for the Chloros?
I will. I promise you I will.
Well, they're probably deciding right now what to do with us. We might as well settle down and wait. We sat there, the five of us, and listened while the Chloran invaders killed off the members of the Starfire's crew. Among us was Colonel Anthony Wyndham, an old Colonel Blimp type with a lame leg. Wyndham had spent his life in the militia back on Earth, but had never seen a battle. There was Demetrius Polyarchitis, who had just watched his brother being killed by a chlorocarbonizer. Polly was a huge man. He and his brother had tried truck farming in Arcturus and given it up after two seasons. Then there was LeBlanc, a sensitive, frightened young man of 22, and Randolph Mullen, who looked like somebody's caricature of a bookkeeper, a mild, balding, milquetoast little man. And there was myself, John Stewart. I was the only one who'd ever had contact with the Chloro people. I had a pair of artoplasm hands to prove it.
It is quiet now.
Yeah, they've finished with the crew.
Mr. Stewart?
Yes, Mr. Mullen.
What do you think will happen next?
Well, they'll put a prize crew of two aboard and take us to one of their home planets as prisoners of war.
Only two of the Chloros will stay aboard?
Two is all they'll need. Why, Colonel? You're thinking of leading a gallant raid to retake the ship?
Well, simply a point of information, Dasher.
All right, then let me give you another point of information. If you want to commit suicide quick, just open that bulkhead door. Three steps inside, you'd fall on your face.
But why?
Don't you smell anything, LeBlanc? Get close to the door.
It smells like gas.
Yeah, it is gas. Chlorine gas. They breathe it like we breathe oxygen. They've chlorinated the whole cruise compartment. One big whiff of that and we'd all be dead. So just forget about rushing the Chloros.
How do you know so much about their habits, Stuart?
I lived on a Chloro planet for 6 months. You see these hands? They were mangled in the oxygenating machinery of my own quarters. They grew these artoplasm things and operate it. They're weak, but at least I have hands again.
Monsieur Stewart.
Yeah.
Will they kill us?
No.
Why do you say that?
Because in their own way, they're gentlemen. Probably will be interned for the duration.
You call them gentlemen? After they kill my brother in cold blood, you call them gentlemen?
You know, Stuart, you sound more and more like a blasted greenie sympathizer. Blasted, man. Where's your patriotism and loyalty?
My loyalty is where it belongs, with honesty and decency, regardless of the shape of the being it appears in. This is a ridiculous war. Why are we fighting these people? We can live only on planets with oxygen, and oxygen is poison to them. They can live only in chlorine atmosphere, which is deadly to us. Yet we're fighting them over a bunch of worthless asteroids that neither of us can live on comfortably.
Well, it's a matter of principle.
It's a matter of stupid pride and greed.
I don't like what you say, mister.
Why not?
Because you talk too nice about these greeny scum. They're good to you, eh? Well, they weren't good to my brother. They killed him. And I think maybe I'll kill you, you rotten greenies.
Right, holy...
Come on, grab him.
I can't break his hold.
They are coming in.
Foley, let him go.
They saved your life this time. But when I'm finished with them...
Quiet. I think they're opening the lock.
Well, don't get between us.
Foley, don't lose your head. They'll kill us all.
Chloro was not a pleasant sight to anyone unused to him. He was about the height of an Earthman, but the top of him was just a green stalk with eyes. He was still wearing a spacesuit to protect him from the oxygen in our compartment. In one of his tendrils, he carried a Chloran gun. As he stood in the doorway, I could see Polyarchetus' eyes begin to glisten with rage. Then, with a bellow like a huge bull, he threw himself at the Chloro.
Is not dead, merely temporarily paralyzed. You five will remain together as prisoners of war. We expect to reach our own planet within several weeks, your time. There you will be interned for the duration of the war. If any of you attempts to leave this compartment, we shall be forced to destroy you. That is all I have to communicate.
Hadn't we better do something for Mr. Polyarchetes?
Oh, he'll be all right. Just hoist him up on the cot.
That's
good. All right, Polly. Can you hear me, you stupid brute?
His voice is coming back.
Yeah. Now, I know what's going on in that thick skull of yours, Polly. You think that when the paralysis wears off, you'll ease your feelings by slamming me around some more. Well, if you do, it'll be curtains for all of us.
How do you mean, sir?
None of you know the Chloros the way I do. Unlike us, they assume automatically that any group of Earthmen they find together comprises a biological grouping, like an ant colony. The result is that they consider the group as something, well, something holy. Now, they'd never break us up. And if one of us did any harm to another, they'd have us all executed as a bunch of Chloro-type perverts, a non-functioning group. So call all the names you want. But keep your hands to yourself or we're finished. My little speech had a sobering effect on the group. For the next 24 hours, we did little besides eat our rations and think. I tried to evaluate them. The colonel I had figured for an old windbag. Polyarchetus was a hate-filled brute. LeBlanc would crack first. He was like a frightened child. Mullen? Mullen was a nonentity, a mouse instead of a man. Everything he did seemed prissyish. His voice had the quality of furtively rustling underbrush.
How long did you say the trip would take, Mr. Stewart?
Well, the Chloro said about 2 weeks.
Gentlemen, if I may interrupt.
Colonel?
Now, it has occurred to me that perhaps you know of some weakness that might enable us to overcome these Chloros.
The only weakness they've got is that they can't stand oxygen.
Oh, but there must be some way to get the best of them, man.
After all, there are only two.
Before I answer, Colonel, I have to know your motive. Is it to save your own skin or help Earth win the war?
Oh, dash it, man, to help our side, of course. What we're looking for is the way to save the ship for Earth without losing our lives, yes?
Well, all right, let's take a vote then. LeBlanc?
I have a wife waiting on Earth, Mr. Stewart. I do not want to die.
Uh-huh. Hero number one. What about you, Mullen?
I don't see how we could accomplish it without...
Uh-huh. Hero number two. Well, Polyarchetus?
When I kill Chloros, it will be with my bare hands. On their planet, I will kill dozens, I promise you.
Uh-huh, three down. Well, Colonel, don't you want to march to glory, an old militiaman like you?
Your attitude is very cynical and unbecoming, Stuart.
I see. Well, then I'll have to blow the ship up myself.
Stuart!
Don't worry, Colonel. I don't intend to be a dead hero.
Of course, there is a way we might do it.
What did you say, Mr. Mullen?
There's a spacesuit and magnetic boots stored in that locker over there. We might be able to reach the control room from the outside of the ship.
The outside? But how would we get outside?
Well, this compartment has a sea chute. It must.
What is a sea chute?
A sea chute, my boy, is a casualty chute. It doesn't get talked about much, but all the main compartments have them. They're just little airlocks down which you slide a corpse. Burial in space.
Oh, blast it, Mullen. Suppose you did get outside. How could you re-enter the ship?
Through the steam tubes, the ones they use to guide the ship.
Wait a minute, Mullen. What do you know about steam tubes? I thought you were a bookkeeper.
Well, on Arcturus, I got interested in spaceship models. I studied all about them. On my own time, of course.
Yeah, naturally.
At any rate, I learned that the steam tubes have an access vent directly to the control room for repairs and so forth.
And the Chloros, they are in the control room.
What do you think, Stuart?
Well, it's a video sort of idea, but it might just work. We could get permission from the Chloros to open the sea chute and bury Paulie's brother. And one of us could slip into it, work forward, and climb up through the steam tube. The question being, which one?
What about you? You with your loud talk and your sneers.
I'm no hero, Paulie. I've already said that. My object is to stay alive. The steam tube let go while you were in it, you'd be broiled like a lobster. Now, how about the colonel here?
If I were younger, blasted, I'd trounce you. You know very well with my injured leg.
Yeah, of course. Not to mention my artificial hands. Well, now, what unfortunate deformities do the rest of us have? Paulie?
You just keep talking, Mr. Big Mouth, and pretty soon we'll kick your teeth in.
Of course, that's your standard reply to everything, isn't it? LeBlanc, will you do it?
I cannot.
Not even to get back to Denise?
Please, I cannot.
LeBlanc needn't go. I'll do it.
What?
After all, it is my idea.
Wait a minute. Are you serious, Mullen?
Yes.
Well, how? I don't understand. Why? Why you?
Well, it seems no one else will do it.
But that's no reason, man.
I can't think of any other.
Look here. Do you really intend to go through with it, sir?
Yes, I suppose I do.
Well, dash it, man. Let me shake your hand. You're an Earthman, by heaven. You do this thing and win or die. I'll bear witness for you.
It was quite a moment. Mullen the Mouse had suddenly turned into a man. He just stood there awkwardly while the colonel pupped his hand. Polyarchetus seemed stunned. LeBlanc was wide-eyed. And I? Well, I was in a peculiar position, one in which I rarely found myself. I had absolutely nothing to say.
That ought to bring them.
I hear one.
One member of our unit is dead, as you know. We request permission to jettison his body out of the casualty chute.
You may do so.
You'll have to open the chute lock from the control room.
I will do so. Is there anything else?
No, nothing else. Thank you. Oh, boy. All right, come on now. We'll have to work fast. Mullen, get into a space suit from the emergency locker. Paulie, help Mom with those magnetic boots.
Hurry.
I'm working as fast as I can. The arm. There.
All right, give me the helmet.
The helmet.
Okay. Now, Mullen,
Better scratch your nose if you have to. It's your last chance for a while.
What about radio contact?
You can talk to us. We'll listen in on the helmet set in one of the other suits. The Chloros won't have their set on the interphone frequency.
Wait a moment.
What for?
Does it? What's he going to use for a weapon? He isn't big enough to fight them barehanded.
Ah, no, that's true. Well, how about one of those oxygen cylinders?
Good idea. Use it to bash them over the head.
Now, give him one of the cylinders equipped with a reducing valve. Now, look, Mullen, if your magnetic boots fail and you start drifting away into space, open this valve. See that? Now, you can use it like a miniature jet and try to blow yourself back to the ship. Understand?
I think so.
Well, I only hope it works. All right, here goes the helmet.
You'd better hurry. The light is on over the sea chute.
Yeah. All right. That means I've opened the lock. Here. Now, can you hear me?
Oh,
LeBlanc, give me that other space helmet.
Yes. Here.
Let me switch on the radio. Can you hear me, Mullen?
I hear you.
Fine. Plenty of air?
Air's okay.
Uh-huh. Polly, open the sea chute. Okay, now help him in. Are you ready?
Ready.
Well, good luck. Close the chute. Pull the ejector valve. Now. He's out. Oh, God, help him.
The light is out.
Yeah. The Chloros have closed the chute lock.
I don't suppose he has much of a chance.
No.
Do you think he knew it?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Should I try to contact him on the radio?
Yes, I think... Wait a minute.
What is it?
Listen, the Chloro's coming.
Good Lord. He's sure to miss Mullen.
Yeah, wait. Polly, get your brother's body on the cot. Put a blanket over it. Pretend it's Mullen asleep. Polly, for heaven's sake.
My brother.
But you've got to do it, man. It's our only chance. Listen, if Mullen could go out there and...
Very well. I will do it.
Earthman.
Yes.
You have jettisoned the body?
Yes.
Good. Is there something further we can do?
No, we are very tired. Our grief is very great at losing one of our unit. We would like to rest alone.
I will respect your wishes. I see that one of your unit sleeps already.
Yes, yes, Mr. Mullen was overcome with grief.
I leave you.
Oh, brother. Polly, I thought sure you were going to rush him.
With that brave little guy out there, what do you think I am anyway? And to think I laughed at him makes me ashamed.
Yeah, I guess I've been saying some things that maybe weren't too funny. I owe all of you an apology.
Do you think it's safe to try the radio?
Yeah, we better. Hello? Hello, Mullen. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Where are you?
I'm standing on the outside of the ship.
All right, now take care. One misstep and you'll be marooned in space. Now, can you find the steam tubes?
I think I've found one of them already. I can feel the rim. I just hope it doesn't let go when I get inside.
Be careful.
I'm going into the tube now. I can feel the ladder rungs they use to repair the inside.
Yeah, well, keep in contact.
In the tube now.
Good Lord. They've let go with a blast.
Yeah, well, it may be the starboard tubes. Mullen.
Still here. They use the other tubes, fortunately. Now, if they don't try to correct for over-deflection...
Yeah, keep moving.
I seem to be... Wait. Yes, yeah, I'm at the end of the tube now, where it opens into the control room.
Good, good. Now, look, there's a small metal door there. Can you feel it?
Yes, I'm afraid it's locked from the other side.
Oh.
I can't budge it.
Mullen, listen to me.
Stuart, I'm scared. I'm terribly scared.
Yeah, all right. Now, hang on. Don't blow up. Listen to me. Are you listening?
Yes.
Take the spare oxygen tank. Bang on the metal door that leads to the control room. The Chloros are bound to hear you. When one of them comes to investigate, try to hit him with a cylinder. Now, aim for the stalk on top of his body. Try to blind him. Will you do that?
I'll try.
Well, now go on. Only one can come. The other will stay at the controls. Now start banging. Any luck?
No, I hear something. Something's opening the lock. The door now. I hear... Ah!
Mullen! Mullen, what happened? Mullen, can you hear me? Mullen! Mullen! Mullen!
Oh, it's no use. They must have gotten him.
Yeah, he was one brave little guy, that one.
But suppose they have just got him in the control room. I mean, maybe he's not dead.
Well,
then maybe one of us could rush them. We could bang on the door and jump the Cloro.
Well, the first guy would be a cinch to die.
Well, I would be willing to take the chance.
You?
Why not? I could try.
Not you. I'm the strongest. I do it.
Now listen, you chaps. I'm an old man. I've got nothing to live for anyway. Suppose I throw myself at the ray gun.
Wait a minute, what's going on here? 20 minutes ago, there wasn't one of you who'd risk his little finger to get us out of here. Now you're falling all over each other.
Maybe Mr. Mullen teaches us a lesson, huh?
Yeah. Okay, Polly, give me the wrench. I'll start banging on the door.
They say that selflessness is contagious. I guess maybe it is. I'd been a cynic all my life, a man who believed in nothing. Well, I'd come face to face with four human beings who proved that I'd been living a lie. I knew what I was going to do now. When the Cloro came to investigate our compartment, I had it all planned. If only my poor, weak hands would hold out long enough.
Ready?
Ready.
Here goes. That should bring him.
Try again.
Wait, listen.
Shh.
It's at the door.
Get ready.
It's opening the lock.
For poor old Mullen now.
Steady.
No! Let him have it!
Wait! Stop it! It's not the Cloro!
Wait!
Good Lord! It's Mullen!
Get the helmet off! That's it! All right, now lift! Mullen, are you all right?
I seem to be quite all right.
Well, the Cloros.
Both dead. At least I hope so.
Well, what happened?
Well, I banged on the steam tube hatch and a Cloro opened it.
Yeah?
I hit him with a cylinder. It blinded him, I guess, but didn't kill him. He grabbed me and pulled me into the cabin. In the struggle, he broke my transmitter. That's why I couldn't talk to you. Finally, I managed to club him down.
Well, what about the other one?
The other one almost got me. It must have heard the scuffle and came into the cabin with a ray gun. What I did, I guess, was pure reflex. The cabin atmosphere was chlorine, of course, and the greenie didn't have a spacesuit on. Uh-huh. So I just turned on the oxygen valve in that spare tube. It was like spraying an insect with poison.
Well, you're a brave man, Mullen. I'd have been scared to death. Mullen, what is it? Mullen.
An hour later, false hands and all, I was at the controls of the ship, headed for Earth. We'd gotten rid of the chlorinating equipment and restored the oxygen naturally. Mullen was asleep in the cabin under a sedative. Or so I thought, until the cabin door opened.
Mullen, for Pete's sake, get back to bed.
No, I'm quite all right now, really. Do you mind if I watch how you operate the ship?
No, not at all. Sit down. You know, I guess I owe you an apology. I didn't think too much of you.
That's your privilege.
No, it isn't anybody's privilege, Mullen, to despise another. For years now, I've abandoned hope of finding any decency in human beings. I owe you a vote of thanks.
You embarrass me, Mr. Stewart. I didn't do it for any heroic reasons, I assure you. Far from it.
Well, why did you do it, Mullen? That puzzles me very much.
Well, Mr. Stewart, I'm a bookkeeper. 17 years ago, I left Earth to work on Arcturus. I never made much impression on anybody on Earth, although I wanted very much to have people like me. Well, about a year ago, I started to write to my family again. Don't ask me why. And then I asked for a leave of absence to go home after 17 years.
Well, I still don't understand. It wasn't patriotism or love of a woman or money or any of those things. What was it?
Mr. Stewart, haven't you ever been homesick?
Have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features A Gun for Dinosaur by L. Sprague de Camp, a story of hunters in the bloodiest and most ferocious arena of all prehistoric Earth, where hunting reptile heavyweights is no job for human lightweights. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you The Sea Chute, a story from the pages of Galaxy, written by Isaac Asimov and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Lyle Sudrow, Stan Early, Bob Hastings, Mercer McLeod, Danny Occo, and John Gibson. Your announcer, Bill McCord. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Next week, on a distant planet in a forgotten colony of Earth, a man is ordered to commit a murder. Listen to Skulking Permit on X-1 next week.
Well, folks, that was Sea Chute from X-1, aired on February the 8th, 1956. Let's hear our last program. Here is X-1 and Saucer of Loneliness, aired on January the 9th, 1957.
Countdown for blast-off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight, the time is June 25th, 1962. The place, a lonely beach. The story, Saucer of Loneliness by Theodore Sturgeon.
My name is Jason Berniades. I'm a newspaper reporter, 31 years old. I write poetry, but I don't show it to anybody because they might laugh. And the things I write about are very important to me. I was an only child. I never went with girls much because I'm too ugly and too sensitive. And they used to hurt me. I live alone. It isn't much fun. I'm not painting this picture of myself to get sympathy. I don't need it. But it's important that you should know the kind of person I am. Otherwise, you won't understand what I'm going to tell you. It happened tonight, the thing I'm going to tell you about. Tonight, the 25th of June, 1962. I was down on the beach.
mister.
What is it, kid?
You seen a cop around any place?
On this beach?
I found this pile of clothes down near the rocks, a lady's dressing room, shoes.
Well, did you see anybody? A girl?
Well, I think so, but she was running along the sand in the moonlight. I yelled to her, but she just kept running, and then I found these.
Look, kid, you go try to find a cop someplace. I'll see if I can find the girl.
Okay.
I thought to myself, she's dead. I'll never find her now in this white flood of moonlight with the surf seething in over the pale sand. I ran and ran until my knees buckled and went down in the swirl of it, the sea on my lips, with the taste of tears, and the whole white night shouted and wept. And then I saw her, waist deep, walking into the surf.
Stop! Stop it! Come back! Come on, come out.
Let go. Let me go.
Don't do it. Please don't.
Leave me alone. Leave me alone.
I'm going to have to hit you. Forgive me.
I hit her in the neck with the edge of my hand, and she slumped. I brought her ashore and carried her to where a dune was between us and the water. Then I rubbed her wrists. She had a pale, beautiful face with ancient, bottomless blue eyes. She opened them and looked at me after a moment. It's all right. Here, put my coat over you.
Why couldn't you leave me alone?
I couldn't.
Why?
Because it's important to me.
I suppose you want to know why I did it.
If I told you I understand, would you believe me?
How could you understand?
Maybe I know what it means to be lonely.
That.
That's it, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm so terribly tired.
Put your head against my arm and just stay. Don't be afraid. I've been looking for you for a long time.
Looking for me?
All my life.
How did you know? I don't believe you.
It's true. I found your message.
Oh?
So you see, there's nothing to be afraid of. Not anymore. Just rest. The moonlight is terribly white.
Yes. I'd like to rest for a while.
She didn't remember it, of course. But I was one of the reporters who had covered the story when it first happened, 5 years ago. I'll never forget that day. I was working the police blotter. It was a quiet summer afternoon when they brought her in. Two big cops in blue uniforms.
Come on now, girlie, come on.
Let me go. I haven't done anything.
Take it easy now.
What's the trouble, Connolly?
Disturbing the peace, Sergeant.
Is this that Central Park call?
Hey, this is it.
I thought you radioed that there was a near riot up there.
Oh, you should have seen the place.
All right, give me the report.
Well, me and Bennett got up there, and there was a mob of people all surrounding this girl, see? So we bust through, and there in the middle of maybe 600 people, she's lying there, sort of in a faint. I asked a couple of people what the difficulty was, and they tell me it's the flying saucer.
The what?
The flying saucer.
What flying saucer?
Let me finish, Sergeant. What flying saucer, I ask. And then they says that this girl was standing on the green, and suddenly the saucer comes down and starts whirring over her head like a halo.
What is this, miss? A gag?
It happened.
It did, eh? Well, now suppose you tell me your version.
I was standing in the park, and I looked up, and there it was.
Describe it.
It was beautiful. It was golden with a dusty finish, like an unripe Concord grape. It made a faint sound, a chord of two tones. And it circled over my head like some great round hummingbird.
Go on.
Well, other people must have seen it because they were all looking at me and pointing. I saw one man cross himself. And then came down and touched me and spoke to me.
This flying saucer spoke to you?
Yes.
And just what did it say to you? I said, what did it say?
I can't tell you.
A secret, huh?
Yes.
I see. Connolly, this girl is for Bellevue.
Well, Sergeant, the plain fact is that it happened just like that. And 10 witnesses all agree it did.
Are you trying to tell me that there was such a thing as this whirring hummingbird of a saucer?
Oh, there was that, Sergeant.
And just how do you know, Connolly?
Well, we've got the thing out in the squad car.
You what?
Bennett's bringing it in right now, see? About 36 inches across it is, and covered with strange markings.
Great, Mother, did you call the bomb squad?
I didn't think of it.
Well, think of it, man. This may be some kind of atomic weapon.
I'll turn it over to ballistics.
Never mind about ballistics. Call the FBI and tell them we've got this thing.
Yes, sir. What about the girl?
We'll book her on disturbing the peace. I've got a feeling the government men may want a word with her.
Sergeant.
What is it, Benitez?
I'd like to do a story on this for my paper. Could I have a look at the saucer?
We'd better clear it first.
Well, could I talk to the girl?
After she's been booked.
Connolly, is the crowd still up at the park?
Very likely.
Well, I'll run up there and get some eyewitnesses. Then I'd like to come back and talk to the girl.
Up at the park, they were still buzzing about it. Some said she was a communist agitator. Some said it was a flying saucer from Mars and she had stepped out of it. Others said she was a saint and it was her halo. I took some notes, phoned the paper, and went back downtown to talk to her. But there were a couple of agents with her, and they wouldn't let me in.
Now then, miss, you told the sergeant this saucer spoke to you. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did it speak to you in English?
I don't know.
You did understand it, though?
Yes.
Do you speak any other languages?
No.
Tell me, what message did you receive from this instrument?
Wasn't anything, really.
Suppose you tell me.
I'd rather not.
Miss, let me be very frank. I'm not a policeman. I'm a security agent. That means that I deal with problems that affect the security of our country. Do you understand?
Yes.
Now, we've examined this flying saucer enough to know that it is not of American manufacture. It also possesses an extremely high radioactive count. Now, that means that it was made in an area where radioactive materials are in great abundance, such as an area where atom bombs are made. That's why we want to know the message you received from the saucer.
There was no message.
You just made it up?
Yes.
I'm afraid you're lying. Suppose we have some soldiers bring the saucer in here and hold it over your head. Would you object?
I don't care what you do.
All right, boys, bring it in. Now, when I tell the men to hold it over your head, you try to recall what it said.
I don't know what it said.
Lift it up, boys. Hold it right over her head.
All right.
It's talking to you now, isn't it?
Yes.
What is it saying? What did it say? All right, boys, crate it up and send it down to the National Research Laboratories.
Right. What about the girl, sir?
We'll get nothing out of her. I don't believe she really knows what that humming noise is. Better have a psychiatrist examine her.
Yes, sir.
Took her to the city hospital, and she had a room to herself. Whenever the door opened, she could see the policeman outside. The door opened quite often. There were a lot of important people, some in army uniforms, who came up from Washington just to see her and talk to her. Apparently, they had analyzed the flying saucer and discovered something that made this girl about the most important person in the country. I used to stand outside, and I could identify the heads of certain security agencies, but nobody would answer the questions that the reporters shot at them.
Sir, excuse me?
Yes?
I'm Jason Benayades from the Trib. I've been assigned to this flying saucer story as chief of the security...
I'm sorry, I have no comment.
Can you tell me how long the girl will be held?
That's a matter for the civil authorities.
Well, have the psychiatrist...
Excuse me, Mr. Benayades. My car's waiting.
A few days later, she was released from the hospital and returned to the court to be tried on the disorderly conduct charge. They found her guilty and fined her $15 and turned her loose. When she walked out of the courtroom, she was handed a subpoena to appear before a congressional committee in private session. She answered all their questions except one. My paper sent me over to cover the hearings.
Now, young lady, I want to remind you that I'm a senator of the United States and empowered by the people of this country to ask questions relating to matters of security. You understand?
Yes.
Your name is Janet Boyce, is it not?
I told you that.
Now, at an earlier session, you testified that as a young girl, you were a member of a certain organization in your neighborhood. Would you name it?
The Rinky Dinks.
Who comprised the Rinky Dinks, Miss Boyce?
It was just a bunch of girls who got together to play field hockey and listen to recordings.
Any particular recordings?
Mostly Eddie Fisher.
I see. Now, this flying saucer, you said it talked to you. You did say that, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you denied it?
Yes.
Why?
Because I was tired of answering questions.
Young woman, let me put something to you squarely. Oh, by the way, I think if there are members of the press here, I can divulge a rather spectacular piece of information to you. This flying saucer has been thoroughly examined and analyzed, and I wish to inform the people of this great nation that it definitely, I repeat, it definitely did not originate on this planet. Now then, Miss Boyce, consider that it is possible that our Earth might be attacked from outer space by beings much stronger and cleverer than we are. And consider that perhaps you have the key to our defense against those beings. Don't you owe it to the world?
I don't think I owe anything to anybody.
Even if the Earth was not attacked, just think what an advantage it would give this country over its enemies. Young woman, I ask you, what did that flying saucer say to you? Do you know that what you're doing is tantamount to working for the enemies of your country? I will give you one more chance. What was the message?
It was personal.
Gentlemen, I move that Miss Janet Boyce be cited for contempt.
The furor was fantastic. The chief of security blasted the senator for divulging secret information about the origin of the flying saucer, and the senator said the people had a right to know, and besides, he was just guessing anyway, and happened to guess right. Meanwhile, the press printed the girl's picture all over the front page and ran banner headlines such as, "Girl refuses to betray Martian secrets. Flying saucer girl won't talk, cited for contempt." The contempt trial was equally spectacular. She didn't plead any amendment or anything. She just said the saucer was talking to her, and it was nobody else's business. She was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison. Benaiades. Yes, Chief. For the Sunday supplement? What, do you think there's anything in it? Okay, whatever you say. Mike, get me everything you can on that flying saucer girl, will you? Yeah, the one that was sent to jail about 4 years ago. See if you can find out what she's doing now. She was released about 6 months ago, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah, the boss wants a feature for the Sunday supplement. Okay. I found out she had gotten a job cleaning at night in offices and stores down near the beachfront. There weren't many to clean, but that meant there weren't many people to remember her face from the newspapers. I tracked her down and caught up with her in a one-armed coffee joint about 4 a.m. Excuse me, miss. Do you mind if I sit here?
No.
Nice night, isn't it? Moonlight and everything.
Which are you? Security, newspapers, or just somebody out for a good time?
You're pretty bitter, aren't you?
Shouldn't I be?
Yeah, I guess you should. My name is Jason Benaiades. I'm with the newspaper.
Well, it's been nice meeting you. I have to go now.
Just a minute.
Please.
I can't blame you.
How did you find me?
One of the leg men located your mother. I talked to her earlier tonight.
Oh. How is she?
Still hitting the bottle. The way she knew where you were, you sent her some flowers on her birthday, remember?
Yes. She wouldn't talk to me. Said she didn't want a daughter who was a jailbird.
Tell me how it's been.
So you can write about
it? I promise you I won't write anything you don't want me to write.
Okay. You want to know how it's been? Right after I got out of jail, I met a man at a restaurant. Nice man. He asked me for a date. I spent every cent I had on a red handbag to go with my red shoes. They weren't the same shade, but anyway, they were both red. And I was very excited about the date. We went to a movie. Afterward, he didn't even try to kiss me or anything. He just wanted to know what the flying saucer had told me. Didn't say anything. I just went home and cried all night.
And that was it?
No. I had another date. I get pretty lonely. This time they arrested the man I was with. He was a Russian agent. On Christmas Eve, four men called me up and sang me a song. Would you like to hear the words?
No, it doesn't matter.
They go, "The flying saucer came down one day and taught her a brand new way to play. And what it was, she will not say. But she takes me out of this world."
I'm sorry.
Now will you go away and leave me alone?
Yes.
Aren't you going to ask me the big question?
No.
Everybody does.
No, well, not me.
You will, sooner or later.
Maybe. Look, can I take you home?
No.
Can I see you again? Please.
I don't know. I'm afraid to let myself like anyone.
Trust me, will you?
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I'll wait here for you tomorrow night.
All right.
The next night, I went back to the coffee joint to wait for her. I knew she got through about 4 a.m. I got there about 15 minutes early.
Mr. Benides?
Yes. Say, you're the chief of the security section, aren't you?
You have a good memory. You mind if I sit down?
Well, I'm expecting someone.
Yes, I know.
Oh, I see.
I'd like to talk to you.
Go ahead.
You probably know that we've been trying to gain the confidence of this girl for some years now.
Yes.
And, apparently you've succeeded where we've failed.
Well, not really.
In any event, you seem to be making some progress.
She may not even show up.
I think she will. Now, I'm going to ask you to help us.
Help? In what way can I help?
We have reason to believe that this girl is a courier for some alien power.
On what do you base that?
Well, there was the incident of the saucer, of course. We've definitely established that it came from some other planet. And recently, she's been throwing messages inside bottles into the ocean.
What sort of messages?
They're always the same. Now, I have one right here. You're welcome to read it and see if it makes any sense. We've had every decoding expert in the service trying to break it, but we can't seem to find the key.
I see.
Now, she's thrown literally hundreds of these messages in bottles into the sea. We've got many of them, but not all, naturally. Now, what we're most interested in is locating the contact.
Naturally.
And that's where you fit in. We'd like you to gain this girl's confidence even further. Try to find out just what these messages mean, and beyond that, what the saucer said to her. You'll be doing us a favor and your country a great service.
You're certain this is some subversive activity on her part.
How else can you explain the fact that she won't tell us her secret?
Maybe because it's hers, and everybody has a right to have something of his own.
Are you, trying to tell me that you won't cooperate?
I didn't say that.
I'd like to remind you, Mr. Benides, that you have a duty to us.
I know that. I also have a duty to myself and to God. If you'll excuse me. I folded the bottle message and put it in my pocket. I waited for her to show up. The minutes went by, and the hours, and I knew she wasn't coming. Or she had come and seen me with the chief and changed her mind. That's when I left the cafe and walked down to the beach. That's when I dragged her out of the surf before she could follow one of her bottles into the water. How do you feel now? Are you cold?
Why should you care?
I do.
Is that why you were sitting with the security chief in the cafe?
I didn't arrange that meeting. He asked me to spy on you.
I suppose he told you about the bottles.
Yes.
Wonder how much of the taxpayers' money they spent gathering them up. I think they'd get tired of it. All the writing in the bottles is the same.
Maybe you could have saved a lot of trouble.
Do you think so? All of them. Judges, jailers, jukeboxes. People. Do you really think it would have saved me a minute's trouble if I told them the whole truth at the very beginning?
Wouldn't it?
No. They wouldn't have believed me. What they wanted was a new weapon. Some super scientific, super science from some alien super race. Science. That's all they think of.
Well, it's pretty important.
Would it ever have occurred to them that this super race from another planet might have super feelings? Or super longings? Or super loneliness? No. All they think about is weapons. Isn't it time you asked me what the saucer said?
No.
They all asked me.
I don't have to ask you. I know.
You know?
Let me read it to you. There is in certain living souls a quality of loneliness unspeakable. So great it must be shared as company is shared by lesser beings. Such a loneliness is mine. So know by this that in immensity there is one lonelier than you.
How did you know?
It's the message you put in the bottles. The same message that some lonely, strange being in some other world put into a bottle, only his bottle was a flying saucer and sent across space to you.
You knew.
I'm lonely too. Look at me. I've never had the love of a woman. They think I'm pretty ugly.
You're not ugly.
No, I don't feel ugly right now.
Say it again. The message from the saucer.
Know by this that in immensity there is one lonelier than you.
I wonder if whoever first wrote it has found someone.
I think perhaps he has. She looked at me and said nothing. But it was as if a light came from her. More light than even the practiced moon could cast. Among the many things it meant was the fact that even to loneliness there is an end for those who are lonely enough, long enough.
You have just heard X-1 presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features I Am a Nucleus by Stephen Barr, the story of a man who felt he was hexed because his comfortably untidy world had suddenly turned into a monstrosity of order. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought to you Saucer of Loneliness, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Theodore Sturgeon and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Elaine Rost as Janet, Nat Polan as Jason, William Keane as the sergeant, Jock McGregor as the cop, Mandel Kramer as the chief, and Wendell Holmes as the senator. This is Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Fred Way and is an NBC Radio Network production.
That was X-1 and Saucer of Loneliness, aired on January the 9th, 1957. I hope you enjoyed that program and have a wonderful evening. Before I go, I want to tell you that these shows were almost about an hour and a half worth of entertainment, and it reminded me to tell you that the marathon's coming up on Saturday, April the 28th. So, come on in on Saturday, April 28th for a bunch of entertainment. I will be one of your presenters, but there's a bunch of other good entertainment coming up that day that you'd really enjoy, so tune in. Peace out, everyone, and have a great day. Bye for now.